So our second to last presentation today will be given by Shazeen, Nicole, Mel, Kayla, Julia, and the supervisor is Dr. Linda Lee, and their systematic review is effects of comprehensive physical therapy for people with rheumatoid arthritis.
Thanks for the introduction, Elizabeth. So as Elizabeth just mentioned, the title of our systematic review is The Effectiveness of Comprehensive Physiotherapy in the Treatment of Adults with Rheumatoid Arthritis. So the outline of our presentation today, I'm going to briefly talk about the background in this area. Shazeen's going to talk about the methods. Julia's going to talk about results, Nicole discussion, and Michaela will address the implications for research, implications for practice, the limitations and strengths of our review, and included studies. So, background. So, as we all know, rheumatoid arthritis, or RA, is a chronic inflammatory autoimmune disease that affects synovial joints and other organs. It is characterized by joint inflammation, joint damage, pain, stiffness, decreased muscle strength and range of motion, and difficulties with activities of daily living. So, RA affects 1 to 2% of the population, and it is 2 to 3 times more likely in females than in males. And individuals with RA are affected in multiple areas of their lives, ranging from impairment of body function and structure to limitations in activities and participation in daily events. So what do we know about this? So our background research showed us that previous systematic reviews have evaluated the efficacy of single physiotherapy interventions. So the Ottawa panel has developed clinical practice guidelines that were actually developed in 2004 that recommended the use of low-level laser, ultrasound, hydrotherapy, TENS, and exercise therapy for persons with RA. And the physiotherapy has been proven to improve outcomes for individuals with rheumatoid arthritis. And the gold standard for care in this population is multidisciplinary care. However, there are a number of alternative methods of care that are now emerging in recent years. So although there is no formal definition of comprehensive physiotherapy, we've defined it for the purposes of our systematic review as a combination of therapeutic interventions delivered by a physical therapist based on client's needs. And we also learned from our background research that comprehensive physiotherapy can be delivered by physical therapists who have entry-level rheumatology training or advanced or specialized training in rheumatology, and this will be discussed later. Julia will bring this up again. So why do this systematic review? Well, currently no systematic review exists on comprehensive physiotherapy for managing RA, and the most effective and efficient method for physiotherapy delivery has yet to be determined, and also because we like to promote evidence-based practice. So the objective of our systematic review is to evaluate the effectiveness of comprehensive physiotherapy for adults with RA compared to weightless control or a single non-pharmacological intervention. And over to Shazeen for methods.
So, for our search strategy, 7 electronic databases were searched, and they're just listed up there. We also performed hand searching. 2 reviewers searched the journal Arthritis Care and Research, and we also hand searched all the reference lists of our included studies. For our selection protocol at stage 1, 2 reviewers independently screened the titles and abstracts for our selection criteria. Articles were kept if the terms rheumatoid arthritis were present, along with physical therapy or physiotherapy or rehabilitation. They were excluded if the terms osteoarthritis, juvenile arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis were present without the terms rheumatoid arthritis. They were also kept if the title or abstract was ambiguous, and they were only kept if it was available in English. So at stage 2, full-text articles were divided amongst the reviewers, and 2 reviewers independently examined each article for our inclusion criteria. And we came up with our inclusion criteria using the PICO formula, where the participants had to be adults diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, and we used the American College of Rheumatology's definition of an adult, which is anyone that's equal to or older than 16 years of age. The intervention had to be comprehensive physiotherapy, which had to be 2 or more types of physiotherapy treatment interventions. The comparison could be either weightless control or medical treatment control, or a single non-pharmacological intervention. And the outcomes, we used any articles that had outcomes that fit into any categories of the ICF. So at stage three, we kind of noticed some common trends that emerged from our included studies. We noticed that half of them had they had the intervention delivered by a physiotherapy that had had additional training in rheumatology, and we categorized these articles into the subgroup post-entry-level rheumatology-trained physiotherapy, which will be referred to as post-entry-level trained for simplicity. And we noticed that the other half had interventions that were delivered by entry-level physiotherapists with just entry training in rheumatology, and they were called entry-level rheumatology-trained physiotherapy subgroup, which will be called entry-level trained during this presentation. It's a lot of words. So for our methodological quality, two reviewers independently scored each article using the Pedro scale. And we chose the Pedro scale because it's designed to assess RCTs for physiotherapy interventions. An article was considered high quality if it met greater than 50% of the criteria. So any study that was that had equal to or greater than 6 out of 10 on the Pedro scale was considered high quality, and we set that a priori. For data extraction, a data extraction form was created for this review. It was pilot tested by all reviewers on 3 individual studies in order to achieve high inter-rater reliability. 2 reviewers would independently extract data from all of our included studies, and disagreements were solved through discussion. For our outcomes, we had a set of primary outcomes which were set a priori, and these were pain, functional ability, health-related quality of life, disease knowledge, and self-efficacy. And we chose these because they were identified to be important treatment goals for people with arthritis. We also had a set of secondary outcomes, and these were any other outcome measures that were utilized within our included studies. And we had those because there are multiple variables that are measured in the treatment of RA, and we wanted to make sure that we didn't lose any results. So we also wanted to make sure that our outcomes fit into the ICF framework, and we chose to use the ICF because of its inclusive nature and because it's a globally agreed upon framework that's used across all health disciplines. So for our primary outcomes, pain fits into the body structure and function category. Functional ability fits into the activity and participation category. We classified health-related quality of life into the activity and participation category, as currently it's not included anywhere in the ICF, and this is where we thought it fit most appropriately. Disease knowledge fits into the contextual factors category along with self-efficacy. For data analysis, we used comparison groups. Our first comparison was between the post-entry level trained versus the entry-level trained or a waitlist control. Our second comparison was between entry-level trained versus a single non-pharmacological intervention or a waitlist control. However, due to the heterogeneity of the interventions used and the outcome measures utilized, a meta-analysis was not possible. So we calculated effect sizes using Hedges G and reported them as standardized mean differences and 95% confidence intervals. We also performed a best evidence synthesis to grade the strength of the evidence. The grading was dependent on the quality of the RCT, so whether it was high or low quality based on their Pedro score, the number of RCTs that showed findings for that specific outcome measure, and whether the results that were reported were statistically significant. So strong evidence was statistically significant findings in outcome measures in 2 or more high quality RCTs. And then it went right down to no evidence, which was no statistically significant findings in any of our outcome measures, or if there were conflicting results between studies that we included. So I'm just going to pass it on to you.
Great. So I'm just going to discuss the results. Our search strategy retrieved 702 articles, and from this, 677 were excluded based on title and abstract because they didn't meet our inclusion criteria. So then we retrieved 25 full-text articles for review, and 19 were excluded for reasons such as the intervention was not PT-driven, it was a single modality intervention. The focus of the study was on cost-effectiveness or cost, or there was no control group. So from this search, we resulted in 6 articles. However, as Shazeen mentioned, we also did some hand-searching, and from this, we found one article that met our inclusion criteria, So in total, we have 7 RCTs for this systematic review. So we have our 2 subgroups, the post-entry-level trained group and the entry-level trained group. So from this, we had 4 studies labeled as the post-entry-level trained and 3 as entry-level trained. Just to give you an example of how these interventions differed, the post-entry-level trained subgroup received additional disease-specific training. So they took extra education courses for rheumatology. And this allowed them to give more specific education regarding the disease, as well as monitoring medications. Also, they were able to provide joint protection techniques and the creation of splints. Whereas the entry-level trained subgroup received basic education, so they could provide education regarding the disease and exercises such as strength and stretching, as well as the traditional modalities. So that's basically how the two interventions differed. So we assessed the quality of our studies using the PEDRO score, and this table lists the names of the studies categorized as our post-entry-level trained subgroup. As you can see on the right-hand side, 3 out of 4 of the studies were labeled as high quality. The one study there by Lee 2006 had a score of 4. This was primarily due to the fact that the measures of one outcome measure were not obtained from 85% of the subjects originally in the group. And this was due to a pretty high dropout rate and no intention to treat analysis. If we take a look at the gradings of our entry-level trained subgroup studies, all 3 received high quality ratings. We calculated effect sizes using Hedges G and 95% confidence intervals, and this table shows the results from the entry-level trained subgroup for our 5 primary outcomes. And I just want to draw your attention to a couple of things. First of all, the data in yellow are our statistically significant findings. So we had strong effects to support decreases in pain and improvements in functional ability from one article by Balgina. However, you may also notice that there were some non-statistically significant findings from O'Brien, and this led to a conflicting result, which we will discuss further. I also want to draw your attention to the fact that some of the studies did not measure our 5 primary outcomes, as well as some of them were not estimable, and this is due to insufficient data. And what I mean by that is, to use Hedges G, we needed point estimate data, and some of the authors reported change scores. So in the event of this occurring, we contacted the authors to see if they could provide us with that data. And one author was actually able to provide us with that, so we were able to calculate the effect size from them. If we take a look at the results of the post-entry-level trained subgroup, you can see that there were no statistically significant findings to show that this intervention was more effective than the entry-level trained group or a waitlist control. But again, note that some of them were either not measured or not estimable due to the missing data. We then conducted a best evidence synthesis based on the results of our calculated effect sizes. So if we take a look at the entry-level trained subgroup, we found that there's limited evidence to support its effectiveness of decreasing pain. No evidence to show improvements in functional ability, and that's due to the conflicting result I just discussed between those 2 authors. Health-related quality of life was not estimable due to the missing data, and disease knowledge and self-efficacy were not measured in this intervention group. If we take a look at the results for the post-entry-level trained physiotherapy group, we found no evidence due to no statistical significance for the 5 primary outcomes that we measured. But at this point, we recognize that there are quite a few findings that the authors reported that were statistically significant, and they were just based on other measures, and we didn't want to lose that information. So we decided to calculate a second best evidence synthesis based on the results that the authors reported, not our calculated effect sizes. So if we take a look at these, the entry-level trained physiotherapy subgroup found strong evidence to support this intervention in the ability to increase key grip strength. There was limited evidence to show that its ability to increase ability of persons with RA to perform moderate to intense physical activity. No evidence was found for changes in range of motion or joint tenderness. And then finally, if we look at our post-entry-level trained subgroup, we found limited evidence to show its effectiveness to increase medication compliance in patients. There were actually indicative findings to suggest that this intervention reduces coping efficacy, and we'll discuss this later. And finally, no evidence was found to support decreases in morning stiffness in this intervention group. So overall, we have limited evidence supporting treatment provided by entry-level rheumatology-trained physios versus weightless control for reducing pain. Secondly, we have no conclusive evidence for the effectiveness of treatment provided by physios with post-entry-level rheumatology training versus the entry-level trained group or weightless control for the five primary outcomes that we measured.
So I'm going to go through the discussion with Michaela. So we're going to address five areas. One would possibly expect greater effects from comprehensive physiotherapy. So some of our results may seem counterintuitive, so I'm going to address this. I'm also going to be addressing the findings for the post-entry-level trained group as well as the entry-level trained group, and then Michaela is going to follow up with the strengths and weaknesses as well as implications for research and practice. So we came up with three plausible explanations for our finding for this counterintuitive results. One of them being due to the heterogeneity of our outcome measures and interventions, we were unable to pool our data, therefore inhibiting our ability to perform a meta-analysis. This resulted in studies with small sample sizes having more effect on our results, leading to insufficient power to detect small but potentially clinically important differences. A second reason, as mentioned by Julia, is two of our seven included studies did not provide means and standard deviations. Therefore, we had to exclude these studies in our effect size calculations, and this limited our analysis for our primary outcome measures. So the third reason we came up with is there was methodological limitations present in our included studies, as there was no control for participants' concurrent medical treatment, therefore limiting the ability to determine whether the outcomes were actually a result of the medical treatment or whether it was due to the physio interventions. However, it should be noted that it would not be ethically sound to deny these patients medical treatment, nor would it actually be a true representation of the RA population. So as Julia had mentioned, there was indicative findings present for deterioration in coping efficacy in the Lee 2006 study, which was in the post-entry level trained group. Again, it should be noted that coping efficacy is a secondary outcome measure, so therefore this finding was from the result, the authors of the study, not our actually effect size calculation. So you may be asking, why a deterioration would occur within the intervention group, as again, this may seem counterintuitive. Well, an increase in disease knowledge has been linked to changing expectations about prognosis. Therefore, it could actually result in a decrease in coping efficacy. This increase in disease knowledge, as well as a decrease in coping efficacy, was actually found in the Lee 2006 study. So also another finding with our post-entry level trained group is there was actually disease knowledge, discrepancy around disease knowledge. In the original studies, the Lee 2006 study as well as Bell, they found statistically significant improvements for disease knowledge. However, when we did our effect size calculation, as this was one of our primary outcomes, we found no statistical significance. So again, you may be asking, why is there a discrepancy between these results? Well, we came up with two plausible reasons as to why this discrepancy exists. One is that the type of statistical analysis used was different. So the authors, both of the study authors used change scores, whereas we used point estimates and standard deviations of point estimates. A second reason is that the sample size required to reach statistical significance. Within the Lee 2006 study, they actually transformed continuous measures into dichotomous variables. This resulted in a decreased sample size that was required for detecting a statistically significant difference, as it reduces the amount of information required in analysis, whereas we used continuous measures, which puts more emphasis on sample size, on a small sample size, that is. So as for the results for our entry-level trained group. As Julia had mentioned previously, there is limited evidence found for decreasing pain within this group. Again, this is one of our primary outcome measures, so this result was due to our effect size calculation. We went to the literature to look at the association between pain and the RA population, and what was found is that chronic pain is common in the RA population, and it's shown to increase over time. Also, there was a strong positive association shown between pain and depression, and that pain and depression can further increase personal suffering, health service utilization, and societal costs. So this illustrates the importance of decreasing pain in individuals with RA. So again, going back to what Julia had mentioned about there was no evidence to support entry-level trained physiotherapy for improvement in functional ability, and this was actually due to conflicting results. So within the Bolgina study, we actually calculated a strong effect for improvement in functional ability. However, the O'Brien study, our calculation showed no effect. But we'd like you to interpret Bolgina's results with a bit of caution, as we went to the literature and looked at all of our outcome measures to ensure that they were all reliable and valid outcome measures, and every single one of the outcome measures was valid and reliable within the RA population, except for this ADL scale. So again, that strong effect needs to be interpreted with some caution. So Michaela's going to take over here with the limitations and strengths.
Okay, so here is an example each of a limitation and strength that were common across all of our included studies, and so they may have affected our results. Firstly, one limitation was that all of the included studies had relatively small sample sizes and consequently low power to detect small but potentially important changes. Going down to the strength, majority of our outcome measures used in the included studies were reliable and valid, as Nicole just mentioned, which is integral in determining whether change can actually be attributed to the intervention provided. So moving on to limitations of our review, despite the high quality assignment of 6 out of 7 of our included studies, sample size was not a criteria examined in the PEDRO scale. Therefore, use of this tool may have overestimated the quality of our included studies. Due to limited translation resources, only English articles were included within this review, which may have led to a language bias. As well, it is possible that there was an overestimation bias, as there could have been unpublished negative studies which were not captured within our review. And lastly, this review did not evaluate cost effectiveness, as Julia had mentioned earlier. By not evaluating cost effectiveness, we may have excluded studies which contain the clinical measure of health-related quality of life. This is because in cost effectiveness studies, quality of life is typically used to measure the effectiveness part of the cost effectiveness ratio. And moving on to some strengths of our review. Both the interventions and outcomes of the included studies are applicable to clinical practice, which contributed to improving the external validity of our review. Next, a rigorous review process was undertaken to ensure all research in this area is captured within this review, as well as that there was strong interrelator reliability between the research team to ensure we interpreted all the results correctly. Thirdly, all our included studies were RCTs, which are the most reliable form of scientific evidence in healthcare. And lastly, the use of the ICF classification system to categorize outcome measures increased the applicability of the findings, as healthcare is increasingly directed towards the whole patient in their environment. I'm just going to talk about some implications for research. As was mentioned previously, in our review, we were not able to perform a meta-analysis. And stemming from this limitation, we recommend that a core set of outcome measures be created to include all aspects of health which fit into the categories of the ICF. Secondly, increased transparency about study interventions, including the quantity and quality of PT rheumatology education, would allow future researchers to pool data. Both of these things would increase the possibility of a meta-analysis being performed. Our third recommendation stems from length of interventions as well as follow-ups. The length of interventions in included studies ranged from 3 weeks to 12 months, and only 3 of the 7 studies conducted follow-ups, with the longest one being 4.5 months discharge. Therefore, we recommend that more studies conduct follow-up measures over a longer time period in an effort to ascertain if change due to the intervention can be maintained over a longer time. In conclusion, all right, so positive results were found for the effectiveness of entry-level rheumatology-trained physiotherapy for the secondary outcomes, key pinch strength, and ability to perform moderate to intense physical activity. For our primary outcomes, limited evidence was found for the effectiveness of treatment provided by an entry-level rheumatology-trained physiotherapist versus weightless control for reducing pain in adults with RA. If we move over to our other category, in terms of secondary outcomes, results were found for the effectiveness of post-entry level physiotherapy in terms of increasing patient medication compliance as well as decreasing coping efficacy. Lastly, inconclusive evidence was found for the effectiveness of treatment provided by physiotherapists with post-entry level rheumatology training for our primary outcomes. However, these results should be interpreted with caution due to the limitations mentioned previously. I'm just going to leave you with a couple of implications for practice. From this review, we have evidence to support entry-level rheumatology-trained physiotherapists providing comprehensive PT. In terms of the additional training, we were not able to provide conclusive evidence to support that physiotherapists with additional training will produce better outcomes than PTs with additional training. We would like to thank Linda Lee for all her support and guidance throughout this entire process, as well as Angela Bush and Charlotte Beck with their assistance in the systematic review. Any questions? Thank you. For example, some of the entry-level ones was doing, say, phoratic hand baths combined with exercise, combined with strength, and that was compared to just giving them strength alone, so that would have been their comparison group. Whereas an example of post-entry level was one study looked at specially trained physiotherapists, which had additional training in being able to recognize signs of whether the medications were working or not working, as well as they received training in communicating with primary physicians about medications and other things that were going on with their patients. And then as well, they had just more increased disease-specific knowledge, so that the education they could provide was a little bit more specific to RA than perhaps an entry-level trained physiotherapist. Does that kind of clear it up?
Yep.
Sort of with that, did you guys find that the entry-level, the other group, were they all from Canada, or was it like from different areas, or?
Actually, the post-entry level, so the ones with additional training, it was kind of interesting because all four of those studies were from Canada, mostly Ontario, whereas the entry-level training were from various places, such as the UK. One was from Bosnia, I think, and one from the Netherlands.
I have a question that's kind of directed to Elizabeth in respect to like a systematic review. Are there any more regulations with respect to supervising an SR in which your own studies are included?
Can we ask that? That's a good question.
I'll let you
answer
that first.
So this area topic is really new, and Linda is actually sort of one of the primary people looking at this new sort of development of physiotherapy. So to exclude her studies would not really be a true representation of our topic. And also, we feel that there was no bias in terms of our interpretation of the results. And Linda merely just provided us guidance on how to do a systematic review, and she didn't sort of incorporate any of the results, unless we actually required additional explanations, which we also did with other authors. So we don't really feel that there's any biasing, and to exclude her studies just simply would not be a representation.
Yeah, there's no set rules against it.
I mean, it's an excellent question because of the perception of conflict of interest.
Yeah.
I think in the traditional narrative review, you know, there is the tendency, you know, to favor one's own work or to or your own lab.
Yeah.
But I think in this case, where the rules are quite clearly delineated and people can do a lot of cross-referencing, and the key thing is, if somebody else did what you did, would they come up with the same conclusion? And you know, I noticed you did come to Linda's defense when she scored 4 on that.
There was another low quality study. It was just that her study was the only low quality, so we felt we needed to explain why there was a low quality.
Right.
And if there was another one, we would have given also explanations as to why it was low quality.
Perfectly valid. Perfectly valid.
Because one of the things that you were interested in was therapists with advanced training, I wonder why in your keywords in your initial search you didn't look for OTs where they also do hand training or hand therapy. Any comment about that?
Well, we included rehabilitation.
Right.
That was one of our keywords. So again, we are not looking at OT, and we didn't exclude studies if it had OT in it, as long as physiotherapy was present. So by capturing using rehabilitation, we sort of included OT.
And in fact, the articles by Linda Lee, she used a primary therapist model, and a primary therapist model is either a PT or an OT, and they get the same training,
right,
and they can do the same thing. So
that's why I was thinking, because it's not PT as such,
right,
or therapy or whatever might be.
At the same time, we just want to make sure that the intervention was PT-driven too, because there have been other studies that have been OT-driven, and we weren't interested as much in those. We wanted
or even the multidisciplinary care teams. We found some of those, but we only picked ones that were driven by a physiotherapist because we were really interested in those.
And there's actually a previous systematic review that focuses on occupational therapy, and so we were just really interested in the physical therapy aspect.
Regarding the entry level, I just wanted to know, do you think having done your PT degree in Bosnia, or whether it's here in Ontario, plays a role in terms of that qualifying it as a whole as an entry level?
I feel, based on the interventions that were described in the papers, that no, because the interventions that were provided were really, really common amongst all
physio programs,
you know, like they're providing stretching exercises, hand exercises, education. One of the limitations is none of the studies really got into the details of their interventions, like what exercises and what specific education. But I think because they're fairly basic interventions, that they wouldn't really have differed that much.
That was actually one of our recommendations, is studies need to detail the amount of entry-level training. So perhaps in studies saying that there was this many hours of rheumatology training, therefore knowing that that can be looked across all studies. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't present in any of the studies. And again, that was one of our future recommendations for study.
That's sort of a comment on what you say, just thinking that if somebody's like entry level, never having taken courses in RA and whatnot, but they've been practicing for 20 years versus somebody who's been practicing for 2 years who just might not have had as much experience with patients with RA just because they haven't had the exposure, don't you think there would be
definitely
a big disagreement?
That's why one of our biggest recommendations is the authors need to say what training their therapists have, because you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
You know, it could play a large role.
It was actually interesting, in one of our studies it was specially trained versus experienced arthritis physiotherapists. And the only significant result they found was the increase in medication compliance. So it was obviously the special training was helping them really with that area, but none of the other results were significant. So it does definitely play into it. But like you said, a lot of them just didn't mention what their entry levels had. So
did they ever mention like the average or
range?
First of all, I want to congratulate you guys. You guys took on a really challenging topic. It's not only have implications for treatment and practice, but also you have an implication for resource allocation. So I'll do the questions first, and then I want to come back and address some of the comments. It was very interesting. My question is that, so if I administrator in a hospital department, and I have to decide whether I'm going to spend money to ask people to go out to take courses in rheumatology to upgrade the skill to provide arthritis care, what would you advise them based on your findings?
Well, from our findings alone, we don't have conclusive evidence to support additional training. But we mentioned the limitations, and we want people to take those into consideration, as well as, so basically we recommend that facilities or managers or whatever, however they decide for their physios to get more education, they look to other outcome measures and not just this review. For example, if they can talk to other people that have taken the courses and how valuable it is, or if they have other measures to look at how well their physiotherapies are delivering services within their facility. But as far as this review goes, we cannot offer conclusive evidence.
And also, we want to bring back to best practice. Best practice includes evidence base as well as clinical knowledge as well as the client. So just because the evidence base doesn't support it, there's still clinical experience. So again, as Michaela had mentioned, go to the clinicians who take these courses and find out whether they're finding they're actually working.
I just want to say one thing about the conflict of interest issue about systematic review. Cochrane, which is the gold standard of doing systematic review, they really don't have any rules and regulations and guidelines. I think transparency is the most important thing. The situation would be very similar, especially for a relatively new field of research, that you don't have a lot of people doing the studies, let alone doing the systematic review. The situation would be like the people who do systematic reviews oftentimes are in a guideline development panel. So, you can argue that there is conflict of interest in terms of, are you going to favor your recommendation from the particular systematic review that you conducted in your guideline development. But I think the issue is that whether it needs to be transparent, who's in it and how the decision's being made. There is a movement in the review literature that people encourage multiple systematic reviews in the area. And this new methodology that's being developed primarily in Norway and the Netherlands to look at reviews of systematic reviews. So they call it umbrella reviews, and you can actually find it in a recent issue of physical therapy, that there's an umbrella review to look at non-pharmacological intervention in osteoarthritis, and there'll be a new one coming up for rheumatoid arthritis.
We were just assessing. We didn't exclude based on quality.
Oh, so you're only assessing
your grading
low
quality
versus high or low. Yeah, grading is high or low where a high quality study was 6 or greater out of 10.
Okay.
And that was used in our best evidence synthesis.
Okay.
That score. That's how we.
Okay, so the study by Lee didn't actually include that in your best evidence.
Yeah, we totally did, but it was indicative.
To go back to the explanation of.
So basically,
it just grades it in the, like, you have strong evidence to no evidence. If you have a low quality study, it brings down your level of evidence.
Oops. Yeah.
For your secondary outcome measures, I was curious to know how many studies were included in the evidence that you, that's another slide, I don't know if you can go through it, on your secondary results.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many studies were included in each of those?
No. How many studies where you say there's limited evidence, strong evidence, limited, yeah.
Sure.
How
so
many studies in each of those?
I can't tell you the exact number, but what I can tell you is that the grading of evidence is based on how many studies found that finding. So to get strong evidence, we had to have at least 2 high-quality RCTs that had statistically significant findings for that to say strong evidence, whereas in indicative findings are statistically significant findings in 1 low quality RCT. So that's how we picked that terminology. It was based on how many. So if the paper had that result, it was included in this. So a lot of the times we have the word no evidence, and that doesn't necessarily mean nobody found anything. It can also mean there was conflicting results. So if one author said, yes, we have statistically significant differences, but the other doesn't, we automatically have to say we have no evidence. So that's how that works. Does that clarify? Okay.
My question is about the subject populations in the studies. I'm just curious about like how all the subjects were at baseline compared to the entry level versus the more advanced train, and also do you think that maybe someone with more severe RA would tend to go see someone with advanced training over from entry level therapists?
But that's in an RCT, you can't. They have to be equal at baseline. So by doing an RCT, and that's why we chose to only include RCTs or CCTs, is that ensures that everyone at baseline is equal, so, and they're randomly allocated, so you can't choose where you're going.
I'm just sort of curious, what was the range of like the severity of RA, like how many joints affected on average?
Yeah, that's a good question. They were all slightly different, like all the articles had slightly different inclusion criteria, but for example, using the classification of severity of 1 to 4, one study just picked levels 2 and 3. And so I think they tried to sort of get more of a homogenous population to control for that, but each article was slightly different.
You mentioned a good point about the coping mechanism, and I just wanted to know if you think that can elaborate on his education. It doesn't matter how educated you are on the subject, it's kind of like how you deliver that education. Mm-hmm. And for the findings, they found that you had decreased coping mechanism in the advanced, is that right?
Yeah, it was in the entry-level trained group. So, with post-entry. So, yeah, the theory that was put out there that because you have increased disease knowledge, you have a better understanding of what's going to happen with the disease, so therefore you could have decreased coping efficacy. So I think you're right in saying that maybe the delivery of that knowledge means sort of you need to take into consideration that it may decrease coping and address that coping efficacy as well.
Sorry, I just can't help to talk about the coping efficacy. The mechanism that's been proposed is that if when someone is entering into the study before they start an intervention, they have a set of values that allow them to judge how confident they feel that they can cope with the condition. After they learn about the condition, especially in chronic illnesses, oftentimes people start to reevaluate how well they're actually able to cope with the symptoms and the disease. Now they understand more what entails in the future. So it's not unusual to see that the coping efficacy actually goes down because they understand more about what's coming. So it's almost like a whether the person understands the reality or not. And I would say that, part of it is that coping efficacy may not be a measure of effectiveness in this type of study. I think that may be the thing that need to point out is that what you're not trying to do is not to improve coping efficacy per se, as compared to improve your self-efficacy of your confidence in managing the condition. Because coping efficacy may change the target.
I'm just wondering on that note, is there any difference between the type of treatment that was provided in any of those studies? What I'm getting at basically is that we know with low back pain, people tend to be classified as being fear avoidant. If you provide passive treatment to those people, we know that their coping efficacy actually decreases. In that study, were they using a lot of TENS, ultrasound, in comparison to education?
No, because the coping efficacy result was found in an article with the primary therapist model, and what the primary therapist model really focuses on is education. Like, that's their main treatment modality. They can also provide passive treatments, but that's not the focus, and the main is educating the patient, looking at medication compliance, and those types of things, so I would say it's more of an active treatment. But thank you for that question.
Yes.
I just also wonder with that decrease in coping efficacy, whether the study length is long enough to not see that increase. So you kind of like go through the stages of handling with disease where you start, you can't help, but you can't deal with that knowledge, and then through time you'll learn to deal with it.
That study actually the intervention was 6 weeks long, and then they did it. That was one of the few that did a 6 month follow up. I'm not sure. I believe coping efficacy was decreased at the 6 month follow up, but who's to say that it only takes 6 months to be able to deal with what has happened to you. So it's kind of what, like, how can we put a time frame on when people are going to start to be able to cope with what's happened? So, but that study did have a follow-up, but perhaps, like you say, it just wasn't long enough to be able to see that leveling out.
And that was one of our recommendations, as well as to lengthen the amount of time for follow-up in future studies.
Was it just the one study that found?
Yeah. So that's why it has indicative findings, okay, as well as it's indicative because it's a low-quality study, so that's why it's not limited.
So I was wondering if they made any mention
I don't think that wasn't the purpose of the paper. However, they did address that in the discussion, yes, and that's where they came up. So again, dealing with that as a future issue of research.
Yeah, they had gone there.
Yeah, yeah, no, that was just that came up with their findings.
I was going to ask whether you had considered limiting your review to some stage of acuity. It looked like you crossed acute, subacute, chronic, and whether you had a discussion regarding whether those outcomes could be
different. We followed the American College of Rheumatology guidelines, so their guidelines have various sort of criteria that you have to meet to fall within RA. I don't know if we could actually tease out you've only had RA for 3 months, or only had RA for...
But I mean, stage of, you know, whether they have an acute exacerbation, because I think the outcomes might be different versus chronic.
Yeah.
I think the breadth of literature is just so limited in this area that we couldn't really limit it that way.
And none of the studies broke it down like that, so we wouldn't have been able to pull out those results. So
that seems like that's an important thing to include in a study, what stage are these patients at, and, you know, because usually you're looking...
I think you're also looking at service delivery, so you want to find out, is this effective no matter if they're having exacerbations or not, or because that's the typical course of the disease, so when you're looking at service delivery, you want to know, like, over a typical course, is this going to work?
Just to add to that, there were a couple studies as part of their inclusion criteria. It would say something like disease stable for the last 3 months, or, you know, I think so. Some of them did attempt to do that, but
that's not typically what you see. It helps to limit the variables that you have.
Yeah. And some did limit if they've had surgery recently, quite a few of them limited, so those participants wouldn't have been included in their study.
Or even if they had joint replacement, PT or an OT in the last 3 to 6 months or something like that.
I was curious regarding comprehensive physical therapy. And you define that as two or more treatments, or interventions. Can you explain to me what the rationale for that was, and why two in particular?
Well, we just felt over the course of a person with RA that typically, not saying all the time, they're going to require multiple different interventions. So we wanted to encompass those multiple interventions. Also, there's a lot of other systematic reviews that have actually just looked at single interventions. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to address the area of topic where it's looking at more than one intervention, because as I think Mel talked about in her background, there's, I think, almost 10 systematic reviews that look at individual, like electrotherapy, thermotherapy, all of those single interventions. So we didn't want to go there because it's already been done. And also the Ottawa panel has come up with practice guidelines on those single interventions. So we wanted to look at the comprehensive two or more.
And we didn't pick any two interventions. It was just as long as there were more than two. So it wasn't like specific two.
But you know, another theme that you emphasized a lot, and I just wonder whether you might want, when you come to publish this, presumably, to highlight, and that is the two levels of practitioner, because I heard an awful lot about that in the presentation. And I'm just wondering whether that would be worth highlighting in your eventual title, because that ended up being quite an important comparison group. And I think, as Linda mentioned, the cost effectiveness and another question about, is all this special training? I mean, it has implications for all of our specialties, really, doesn't it? So, I mean, is that something...
We considered discussing the differences between the two, but we're hesitant just because our evidence is so inconclusive, and we don't really feel like we can come out and say, no, don't go do this additional training, or yes, go do this additional training.
But the fact is that was part of your methodology, ultimately, that you separated them out.
It became part of it. Yeah. Initially it wasn't, and then it's something that we noticed in the
studies that there are these two different groups. So,
yeah, I guess we could maybe find a way.
It might be worth considering, yeah. I think, because it ended up that's the way you partitioned
right.
the information. And I think lastly, I alerted in one of your slides, no evidence, and one of the classifications was no statistical difference. Isn't that evidence, provided the study's suitably powered? Isn't that evidence?
Well, it's all in terms of the best evidence synthesis, and if you look at the way it's laid out, no evidence is just a classification of what we're trying to say. So mm-hmm. for if the criteria of no evidence.
But and with the use of effect sizes, you're saying there's no evidence for the difference between the two groups. So mm-hmm. we're not.
But no statistical significant finding. To me, that's evidence.
Well, we didn't make up this scale.
You're presenting it.
Yeah.
You don't have to defend.
But at the same time, when we say there's no evidence, we did report those findings, so we are still reporting that there is no evidence, which means that there was no.
We're saying that there's no evidence to support the effectiveness of this intervention over another.
Over another.
So that's what we're saying. We're not saying no evidence.
Maybe what you're saying is absence of, as opposed to there was a statistical non-difference. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so maybe that's really
just
absence of it.
I just don't know if we can.
And I think as well as we commented, when things were not reported, they were commented as not measured.
So not no evidence.
Yeah, not no evidence. So they were not measured.
Not measured, yeah, it's just quite different. Were there any remaining questions?
Yes. I love the laser, I think.
That's not something that they can change, unfortunately, because
yeah.
that's a standardized
yes, I
category.
Yeah.
However, I think your point is great, and you know, first, that's something that can be discussed in the discussion of the paper, you know, such as the wording.